So, you are young, restless, and reformed, and you want to bring change to your non-reformed church. What should you do? Should you start a Calvin study group in your church and invite people to attend so they can get to know Reformed theology and hopefully over time convince most of the people in your church that what you believe about doctrine and practice is biblical and that the church should change its beliefs and practices and become Reformed? Or should you leave your church, find a Reformed church where people already know these beliefs and practice these things? In other words, should you be neighborly? Or should you arm yourself with righteous zeal and become a crusader and a grassroots revolutionary in your church? This is a very important question, and we want you to join us in this discussion as we talk about grassroots change in the church. So stay tuned with us on Sinners and Saints.
In an age of moral bankruptcy, political sleaze, and man-centered religion in a compromised church, we bring you a Bible-based 21st century Christian faith. This is Sinners and Saints, theology with an edge.
Okay, so here we are today dealing with another very popular blog post that's sort of circulating around out there on the internet, written by Pastor Kevin DeYoung. And I got to say, there's some of it that's very wise and prudent and engages a very important and relevant discussion, I suppose. What do you do if you're becoming Reformed? And this is a question that we've had answered a lot of times on this particular broadcast. We've had people email about it. We had a lot of private and personal discussions with people who are in churches that are not Reformed, and yet these people get a taste of the Reformed doctrine through reading books or whatever, discussions with their friends. And there is this thing that a lot of people wrestle with. Should they become a zealous reformer? Should they become a crusader? Should they go to their local church and advertise that they're going to have, as part of the Bible study groups meeting in the church down in the basement, a study on Thursday nights at 7:30 on Calvin's Institutes or something, and have their own little Calvin group? And it always comes with this great justification. Well, hey, we don't want to divide the church. After all, the church is already divided. So we don't want to leave our church or start another church that's Reformed. We want to stay right where we're at. We can enjoy all the relationships that we have and the worship style that we like, but have the added benefit of the doctrine. Well, this is a problem because a lot of people are wondering, what should they do if they begin to adopt Reformed theology and some of its practices and worship? What are they supposed to do when their local church isn't like that? And that's what Pastor DeYoung does here. And he says what kickstarted this whole discussion for him and his thinking was that the question was posed to him at a conference. Now, I want to say right there, just to borrow a line from Rush Limbaugh, stop the tape. Stop the tape. Isn't this the problem, Pastor Adam? We have all these pastors running around, going to these conferences, mugging for pictures, delivering their soaring addresses, you know, warming up enthusiastic crowds who have hands stretched high into the air because of the new cool Christian rock music. And then at the end, they're so into this reform stuff, they just got to go change the world with it. But isn't the problem starting here? Before I even get into the rest of this discussion, I think it's probably fruitful for us to think about, isn't this part of the problem, the conference thing?
Well, I've said it before, but more specifically, what the conference problem is that the Reformed ministers are at the conferences hand in hand with people who are not Reformed pastors. So then it becomes a mixed message. Because I think, on the one hand, there wouldn't be anything wrong with a Reformed pastor who is clear in his message that X, Y, and Z variations of church are illegitimate and you should leave. And if that's his message accompanying his in the abstract reform doctrine or whatever the topic of the conference is, giving the reformational perspective on it, then I think that's fine.
Yeah.
Because it would be unambiguous, right? His point and his position and his posture would be clear. Of course, if he has that posture, he's not going to be invited to the conference.
Well,
we know that.
Isn't this the point with all this stuff is you're not going to be invited if you're honest up front.
Right. In that way, definitely not. Right. Well, you're just as long as you can be seen as the sort of ornery guy who always talks about election or predestination and, you know, shares the general enthusiasm for the word of God or whatever, you'll be accepted in that circle. But if you have that clear message and edge about you that you're there to say something distinct, and not only to say something distinct, but even in view of what you have in common with the other speakers, you are calling people out into confessional churches, then it's a whole different ballgame. But my point that I've talked about before is I don't think that Reformed pastors generally are very clear themselves about what they think about whether or not it's legitimate for people to be outside Reformed churches.
Well, here's the deal. I'm not saying this is Pastor DeYoung's position, but I think I've heard it enough to be able to say that this is in the air, at least when this discussion comes up, particularly with high-profile pastors who go to these conferences and speak. They pay lip service to the idea that they believe in the unity of the visible church. And they talk about how we should promote that and be interested in it. And that is the justification even for going to these conferences, so that they can promote a greater unity in the visible church, because after all, it's so fragmented. We have Presbyterians and Reforms of multiple different stripes and flavors, not to mention these so-called quote-unquote Calvinists or Reformed churches that are either independent or they're part of Baptist denominations. And so the justification often provided by high-profile pastors is to go, well, I'm just going there to promote the unity in the visible church. It's sort of a feigned presentation of church unity. But the problem with that is, as you're pointing out, you haven't defined what it means to be unified in the visible church, because you haven't defined the visible church. So you have to start by defining, well, what is the church? What is its constitution? What are its marks? What are its features that identify it to the world? And this is a problem right here, because these conferences never start with that, as you pointed out. Why? Why don't they? Well, because they would define themselves out of existence. They would realize that we're all the same church, then there's no meaningful theological distinctions. If every church that claims to be Christian is part of the big visible church, then we are united because we all believe in Jesus. But if that's not the position, now you got to go through the hard work of saying, well, what is a church? And as soon as you do that, what happens? You inevitably leave people out of the equation. Now there's more division and there's more argumentation, and they claim they don't want to be a part of that. So much of it has to do with right here. How do we conceive of the true visible church? And it doesn't seem like he's getting into that very far. But, you know, what you're saying, one way around this is just be honest. If you get an invitation from, let's say, the Gospel Coalition, what should you say? If you're a pastor who believes in the marks of the true church, what should you say?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not going to make my own opinion about that absolute standard for everybody. But my immediate reaction, I haven't given much thought to it, is I wouldn't participate in it. Because, again, the appearance of spiritual, visible, ecclesiological union that you give with your conference participants or speakers, I think is a very powerful message, probably more powerful than anything that you're saying. This is kind of my big concern about the conference circuit in general. It's not so much what the individual guys are saying. It's who they're standing up there with, who they're legitimizing by participating with them in a conference. So, you know, I can see another Reformed pastor saying, well, I'll participate in it, but just so you know, almost inevitably as part of my talk, I'm going to mention the marks of the true church and the unacceptable kind of doctrinal differences that are certainly welcome within this conference statement of faith and amongst its typical speakers or whatever. So I could see a guy responding to an invitation that way.
The fact of the matter is, doctrine divides, right?
Right.
And so if you're going to a conference to talk about your doctrine, which is what you should be doing if you're speaking, because you're speaking from the Word of God, and the Word of God is full of doctrine. So if you believe your doctrine is biblical, there's no way to go to that conference without initiating change at the grassroots level, because people who are at that conference are not going at these so-called ecumenical conferences are not going there from the same denominational backgrounds. They're very scattered. They're very different. The idea is, well, we have certain elements of the truth in common, but it can't work that way, because doctrine, practice, church life, and worship, they all go together. You can't separate these things. So if you're going, you are basically saying, I'm giving you a license to become a grassroots revolutionary in your church.
Yeah. Or to come at it from another perspective. If we believe that membership and participation in the life of a local congregation is a fundamental aspect of Christian discipleship, it doesn't strike me as appropriate to participate in one of these conferences and not speak directly to that issue, to get people out of their illegitimate churches and call them into true churches, because the alternative is to let them believe that they should be where they are. You know, it's inconsistent to me. In the article, DeYoung talks about how all the pastors, when asked this, basically said, no, you should not start a grassroots movement. But what about their message is consistent with that?
Yeah. What is consistent with having these ecumenical conferences where you know you are going there to impart information to people who don't believe it, who are in churches that don't believe it, and yet you're asking them to come and to listen to you? Now, you are either going in bad faith on the one hand, saying, well, I'm going there and I'm going to pretend that I'm not trying to change their mind. I'm just giving them my perspective, which isn't fair or honest, because you should be going there to change their mind. Or you are going there to change their mind. Now, if you change their mind about theology, you cannot tell them, oh, well, just be content with where you are. Because that doesn't work either, because the theology has to be applied and it has to work its way out in the life of the church. And that person's going to a church that just doesn't believe this. So, I don't know, it seems like there's a lot of mixed messages being sent in this whole conference mentality that, man, it's overwhelmed our Reformed church situation now.
Right. It's, to me, the whole question of should you start a grassroots movement, what the question is really about is the legitimacy of the church that a person belongs to. Because if it's a true church, then on any number of issues, even important issues, you might advise a struggling member who is becoming more theologically mature in X or Y way to work with the legitimate Christ representing authority in their local congregation to advance change and sanctification. That can be commendable in some cases, but if it's not in the fundamental sense a church to which someone ought to belong, then they need to get out of there. Now, I also respect the process of helping somebody try to figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I respect the interaction that has to happen between whether it's pastors or elders or lay members of true churches and their friends and loved ones who are in other churches and trying to learn more about the, say, confessional distinctives and the differences and navigate their way through those issues. But the perspective from the Reformed side, say in this case, needs to be one of consistently saying, look, let's not get sidetracked on secondary issues, but for these fundamental reasons, these biblical reasons, this is how Christ's church ought to look.
Right.
And if you're not in a church like that, you need to go elsewhere. And that's why I think what DeYoung said was also true and good.
Yeah, I don't want to take that away, because I think he said a lot of things that were very pastorally wise and even biblical, and I think we're going to agree with a lot of it.
Yeah.
It's just this failure to define, well, what is a church up front? You know, what is a true visible church? We should all be interested in promoting the unity of the true visible church.
Right.
But that true visible church is defined by its marks and its theology. And if you're in one of those churches that doesn't meet that, I don't know what else you could say to somebody who attends those conferences. But you need to listen to what I'm saying and evaluate it according to the Word of God. And if what I'm saying to you is true, you should long to either change your church or be out of there. How could you just stay in a church that you know isn't conforming to the Word of God and isn't being biblical in its doctrine, its worship, and its practice? So it seems to me the assumption is when you buy in, when you go to these conferences to give your theology, it seems to me this is where the disingenuous comes in this whole question. It seems to me you ought to be going there to persuade people to say, hey, look, I know all of you guys don't agree with this. But let me tell you what, when I come, I'm going to tell you what I think, and I'm going to say you should act on it because the Bible says you should, not because I say it. And if there was that kind of candor up front, maybe these conferences would do something useful. These people would have to acknowledge the differences that are deep and that are substantive and are really breaking churches apart and are actually leading to divide, because we can't unite together around false gospel, false doctrine, and false worship. There's going to have to be change. And so I think that's a framework for us to start working with and work our way through some of these details. By the way, I'm Pastor John Sawtelle from All Saints Reformed Presbyterian Church in Brea. And joining me as usual in the discussion is Reverend Adam Kalushin from Ontario United Reformed Church. And you can check us out on the web, OntarioURC.org or AllSaintsReform.org. Please, we invite your discussion. We're glad that you're joining in, that you're downloading the podcasts. Go on the Facebook page, leave your remarks, interact with us. We really appreciate it. We're dealing with topics that we think are contemporary. Some of the shows we've been having more of late is designed to notice what's out there in the media, more broadly speaking, and how is it affecting the church, particularly the Reformed Church. And how should we be thinking through some of these issues? Obviously, this is an important one because it comes up so often. And obviously, it's relevant and it's contemporary. It's just posted up very recently here on a blog spot that a lot of people go visit and check out, where they're asking these kinds of questions. Where does my theology lead me if I become Reformed? And maybe just to also bring this in here, I was just noticing an article posted up very recently at Christianity Today about how the Southern Baptist Church is dealing with new Calvinism and is it going to divide the church. And of course, since Colin Henson wrote that book on Young, Restless, and Reformed, it basically was about Baptist churches becoming Calvinistic, that is, believing the doctrine of election. There has been a swelling of the ranks, at least among younger evangelical Baptist members, to promote that within the church, and it's really tearing up the SBC. And so it's interesting, an article just came out about how the appointed people from this committee within the SBC got together, and they were able to hammer out their points of agreement. Can you imagine that? The Arminians and the Calvinists were able to say, well, we've built a framework so that we don't have to leave the church. Now, that's a little bit interesting. That wouldn't be our take on this. Arminianism and Calvinism go together about as agreeably as fire and water. So we couldn't propose to you that. We'd say if you have a theology, it's got to be applied consistently. And I think DeYoung is working with that, but let's just work through some of the things he starts to talk about here. He's got some suggestions. What do you do if you're in one of these church situations? And obviously, if your church doesn't share your theology, he advises you to pray for a humble heart, first of all.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is a caution that people generally who see problems in other people, maybe in their pastor, in their church, are inclined toward a lack of humility or whatever. I mean, it's a toss. Obviously, there's no problem with that. We should all be praying for a heart of humility.
It's like, how do you get irate about this one?
Yeah.
I can't believe you. You're encouraging prayer. That's terrible. It's an obvious place to start. Let's say there's nothing really wrong with it.
Let's grant someone the benefit of the doubt that they are
meek
soul, but they are just noticing problems that they can't get out of their mind.
We could also say this. I mean, I think it is possible to say that sometimes when maybe especially people who lack real growth in spiritual maturity and maybe even life experience and some of the wisdom that goes along with it, when they do get a hold of Reformed theology, can sometimes become very abrasive. And so what he says here is, he says, pray to be humble in heart. In other words, deal with the people at your church in a respectful way. And I think that's a very good point. Even if you disagree with your pastor and the elders and your friends in that church, you know, the second general commandment applies: love your neighbor as yourself. In other words, treat people respectfully and with dignity, even though you're disagreeing. The theology is divisive enough. You don't have to be personally in your own way of handling it.
Right. And this is also why the assumption is so important. The assumption being, for this, a lot of this advice to be legitimate, we would say, is that you're in a true church. Because there's a certain submission that's required of all of us, that's reflected in our attitudes even, toward authority, servant authorities in the churches, that even if we have disagreements, you know, we have to display. But if you're not in a church, if you're just in a place that calls itself a church, you're not obligated to be submissive to these authorities. In fact, you would separate yourselves from them and you'd go be in a true church. Now, in terms of being kind toward others, absolutely. Part of what I wonder, though, this humble, what does that mean? I mean, does that mean you never tell somebody to their face that was your pastor, so-called, you know, he's a false teacher, or that he's, you know, not qualified to teach what he's doing, and he's actually fighting against, you know, basic historic Protestant confessional truths for the sake of liberalism or whatever. I mean,
you got a good question there, Pastor. Yeah. I want to explore this a little bit more. We're up against a hard break here. I think this is good. Let's go away to the break thinking about this question. Okay, you're to pray to be humble, but what does that mean? Does that mean you're to submit to their counsel or their instruction? How is it that you go about this process of after praying that for humility, demonstrating it? Because this is an important question we'll need to deal with a little bit more after the break. Don't go away. You could check your email or something. That's not a big deal. But come back after the break and join us for some more Sinners and Saints. Being a Christian today is not easy at all. From every side, Christians experience a relentless attack on their beliefs about God and His absolute unchanging Word. Outside the church, secular humanism is working hard to challenge the very concept of truth, while inside the church, too many diminish the significance of biblical truth by focusing on music and entertainment rather than careful teaching of the Bible. In a culture dominated by the influence of unbelief and doubt, you need solid ground for your faith to rest on, and that solid ground is preaching and teaching of God's inspired and inerrant Word. Hi, I'm Pastor John Sautel, and I want you to know that I understand your struggles, and that's why I'm inviting you to All Saints Reformed Church, where God and His worship come first, and where His Word is taught verse by verse. For more information about All Saints Reformed Church, check us out on the web at allsaintsreformed.org. Come experience the renewal of your faith through expository preaching and biblical worship. Okay, we're back here after the break on Sinners and Saints. I hope you got yourself, poured yourself a nice hot cup of coffee and you're ready to settle in to think with us a little bit more about this whole issue of what do you do? You went to a conference or you read a book. You got a friend who won't leave you alone about this total depravity, sovereignty of God, and then even threw in their infant baptism, maybe even some stuff about what is worship, what is true worship, how do you know whether you're worshiping the Lord. You get all these thoughts rattling around your head. Next thing you know, you go to the Bible, you see that those things are really there, that there is a biblical basis for this faith and this doctrine. And, you know, the question is going to come up, well, where do I go? And you're going to have people pulling you in a lot of different directions. That's the honest truth. Maybe your family goes to this church that you go to, and it's a false church. And they say, well, yeah, you know, you're young. You're inexperienced. You don't know very much. Just keep learning on your own. That's fine. But come to the church you've been at. It's kind of a common response. Or maybe you run into three or four guys in that church, and they believe like you do, and they are ready, man. They have the zeal of a reformer, and they're going to change that church upside down, inside out. What is it that you're supposed to do here? Pastor Adam, you're leaving us at the break with some thoughts here about this whole question of what is it to be humble? What does it look like to be? You prayed for the humility, which was DeYoung's point. Not a bad point, but what does it look like now when you're in this position? You're not in a church that believes it. It doesn't seem like anybody around you believes it, or they do, not very many. Pastor doesn't seem to. What do you do?
Yeah, or maybe one of the pastors, right?
Oh, yeah, right.
Maybe it's the youth pastor or the junior pastor. Again, I think of it, I mean, how do you ask the question biblically? To me, the answer to the question is an application of Paul's instruction to submit to the authority of the, the servant authorities in the church, the pastors and the elders. If you can do that, and disagree on secondary type issues.
Yeah.
Great. I mean, we all have to learn to do that.
But there you're bringing in a term that's just loaded.
Yep.
With
secondary.
Yes. Yeah, so what is secondary? You know, somebody joked one time about Martin Lloyd Jones. He never met a doctrine that wasn't important, you know? I mean, because he could always trace the one doctrine back to this grand scheme or whatever, you know, how everything was absolutely integral to the whole system. So you can't isolate a doctrine somewhere. But let's say it's secondary, all right? But here you've got, it's not secondary in your church because most people are not listening. They don't teach it. They certainly don't apply it. Often you know, it's weird how, I think both of us have heard about this a lot, where guys will hear about Reformed doctrine and they'll go talk to their pastor or somebody on staff. And what they get is, shh, maybe the pastor holds to it privately or personally, but knows if this gets unleashed on the church, what's going to happen? Well, it's
division.
It's going to upset the apple cart. So, you know, they might feed you some stuff on the side to sort of, stoke your appetite or whatever, but they don't want that publicly being taught in the church because they know exactly what's going to happen. It's going to cut right into the bottom line.
Right. Or it can be taught, but at a different service that the other pastor leads.
Yeah.
But the main church service will not, encompass those sort of distinctives and ideas that are interesting some of the younger people or people who are getting into Reformed theology or whatever. There's all these kinds of ways DeYoung warns about some of them, churches within churches.
Well, that brings us probably into the second point here. We're getting really close to it, which is, he says, take note of your position, how you think about laboring for change in your church, and how you think of whether to work for change at all has everything to do with your position. Now, let's just stop right there. Are you a member? See, you really can't work to change a church in which there is no membership, nor can you work to change your church if you are not a member of the church? And we shouldn't take that for granted, because too often what we're finding is that it's just passé to have membership in church anymore. I mean, lots and lots of these evangelical churches, they don't have any concept of membership. And so I think this is an important question to start with. Is there membership there? Are you a member? That would have something to deal with, some bearing on how you deal with it.
I suppose to me that's not really that important, because if a person is in a well, I guess if a person's in a true church, and they're not a member, yeah, then this is an issue. They should join that church and officially become a member and work for change. But in that case, we're talking about working for change, and it's legitimate to work for change in the context of a true church.
Yeah, but
and be patient
if you're
with
not a member, if there's no membership in your church,
but let's
there's no reason to even being there. You, yeah. You're just out. I mean, I think that solves the problem yeah. for you right off it. If you're not a member, there is no member. You're not subservient to any pastors or elders.
Okay.
What's the point of interacting with
okay,
them?
Okay, but I'm saying
there's
let's
nothing there.
All right, but even if you are, even if you're a pastor of a church, I don't care if you're a lay member or a pastor. If it's not a church and you've come to realize that,
nothing
you got to go.
Yeah.
Okay, so I get the whole part about not wanting to blow up any good work of the Lord that may be happening in spite of the malformed structure and the total disobedience to his word in so many obvious ways. But, you know, that can be taken care of when you bring yourself and your people under the care and shepherding of a true church and a legitimate congregation, which, you know, obviously true churches are readily available to provide.
Right.
So I'm not really concerned about if you're more a person is more of a lay person or the pastor or an elder position of authority in a false church. In fact, that shouldn't keep you more there. I mean, if you've come to the conclusion that on matters of the gospel or on matters of the sacraments or on matters of the fundamental structures of church discipline, if that stuff is not in place, you've got to go. There's no
right.
there's no time to tinker around with, am I going to stay? And
Pastor, here's what I mean by that, though. Let's say you are a member. The church does have a membership and all this stuff. I think that it's a good idea to go to your pastors and your elders and tell them why you're leaving. In other words, you're making it clear that the truth doesn't obliterate, categories of authority and submissiveness and all these things, which I think are important. If you have joined a church and you know it has this structure to it and there's some semblance of a biblical government and membership, you should at least follow what I think is a respectful, proper manner to go tell people why you're leaving, not in a divisive way, but go to the pastor and the elders if they'll hear you. Sometimes they don't. But I remember a guy who did, and he said, you know what? I just have different – I've come to different convictions now, and I'm going to leave the church, and I want you to know why. And in this gentleman's case, it was very respectful and proper. They prayed for him and said, brother, we hope things go well. So he had a door for when he was done to continue to talk to people who were there at that church. He didn't just crash and burn the whole project, which
right.
can happen sometimes,
right.
and that's not useful at all to anybody.
Right. I totally agree with that, but I it's important to me to make the distinction between being gentlemanly, loving, honest, forthright, which is what you're talking about, and that is not submission. Because the point at which you have to leave is you're leaving because you realize you may not be in submission to these people anymore. So yeah, you need to be honest, you need to be kind, you need to express clearly why you're leaving. In most cases, I mean, unless it's like an abusive type context,
yeah,
where the faster you can get away from there, the better. But you know, under normal circumstances, it's just you become convicted of these truths that are not taught there. At least the opposite is tolerated there.
We've run into this with people in Calvary Chapel situations. There's no membership. There's no semblance of church government there. And they go talk to these things, and then they get hammered by the staff and stuff. And they get guilt manipulated, and they're told they're black sheep and they're straying. And they use all these metaphors, which they have no business to use anyway because they don't have membership. They don't have biblical polity or anything at all. But they can get really battered in that process. Then in that case, you just go. You don't have to fool around with those people who are so obviously in denial of the core elements of the faith. There's no reason to leave anything. There's nothing there. There's no there, if I can borrow that term. But in the membership situation, you know, I think that at least you can just say why you're leaving. Now, I'm going to leapfrog over one point and get to another because I think it's tangential. It fits here. And he says, don't talk up your concerns. So let's say it is one of those situations where there is a membership in the church. There are pastors and elders and so forth. And Yeah, this is going to get into some other questions. What are significant issues? When do you leave a church and all that? But just for now, let's tuck this one in here and talk about it for a second because it works. He says, don't develop a following. In other words, don't have the Young Calvinist Club. Don't try to surround yourself with a bunch of malcontents who just like the idea of, you know,
being malcontents.
Of smashing windows, you know.
Yeah.
They don't mind spraying the parking lot with graffiti. You know what I'm saying? I'm not saying that, but you get my drift here. He said, don't do that. Now, why would that be important? Let's test this a minute. Why would it be important not to develop a circle of discontents with you?
Well, because it makes the reason in the eye of people that are watching you leave, why you left, your negativity or your, you know, bad attitude as opposed to the legitimate reasons why you're leaving. So, I think that's good advice. You have to be careful about who you cultivate. But there's a few questions I have about this. So don't cultivate a following. Well, yeah, in a false church, and I think you mentioned this at the open, Pastor, you know, the solution when you become convicted of Reformed teaching about the gospel and you become convicted about Reformed teaching in relation to the sacraments and worship, and you become convicted about Reformed teaching when it comes to church discipline, the solution is not to create that subgroup within your false church that at best tolerates some of the pastor's teaching Reformed ideas, though usually not with that name and not too explicitly so as not to, you know, ruffle other feathers. But you're not supposed to, is what we're saying, stay in your false church and have your little Calvinist clique. This is so common today. I mean, it's like, it's an assumption that we would never leave the church that flatly contradicts the scriptures on so many ways, or at least tolerates that by some of the teachers and pastors in the group of churches or whatever. But as long as we can stay and have our little small group or segment of the church or youth group or whatever that can be Calvinistic oriented, that's acceptable. That is totally misguided.
Yeah. But now let me bring something in here that might be a shade different. And I don't mean for it to muddy the waters unnecessarily. But let's say you're coming to these, because I'm certain there are people who are listening to this who are in this position. They're coming to Reformed doctrine, and they have friends and associates and so forth in this situation. They're not ready to make the leap yet because they're still learning. But the question I have here is, are we saying to that kind of a person, are we saying to you, hey, if you're learning, you're coming to these ideas, don't say a word to anybody else around you? Or is it legitimate for you to say, here's what I'm struggling through. Here's the books I'm reading. Here are the biblical passages that are challenging me. And spread that around to your friends. Is that the same thing as creating sort of an undercurrent, a movement in your church that's illegitimate, as just fostering, a whole group of people just like to smash the windows?
Right. So my answer to that would be, it depends on the nature of your relationship with the people that you're talking to. So if you have people who,
plenty of your friends,
what you share, yeah,
natural,
your friends,
family members
in the church context,
then
it's perfectly legitimate, in my opinion, to talk to them about it.
Okay.
Because that's the nature of your relationship.
I've
gone through this whole thing myself,
yeah.
So I'm obviously maybe filtering what I'm
You've
hearing
been sectarian.
Through my experience.
Okay.
Right? Yeah.
We've forgiven you a long time ago for that.
Right.
Shall we absolve you again?
Yeah, you may. I will gladly receive that. So if you think about it, what I had in common with particular people was my spiritual interest, say. And so as I have, you know, new questions and new ideas and new understandings of the Bible or whatever with these people, then it would only be natural for me to share with them, you know, those ideas and questions and bounce things off each other. But, well, and I should say, I would be willing, as I was willing, if I had to do it all over again in that situation, I would. You know, people that come to you and hear you're thinking about this or that and want to engage you in discussion, that you should participate in that. But I think DeYoung's point is good in that you shouldn't go on, you shouldn't make for yourself a platform in that context where now you are saying and doing things that are in clear contradiction to what the pastors and the elders of this church have said. Even if, let's say, you're not ready to join a Reformed church yet because you're still working through this or that issue, that's understandable. But if that's true, if you're going to still be in that old context where you are, you don't want to give yourself a platform.
Let me peel back the principle here, because I think what you're onto is important. And the principle is honoring Christ's authority in the church. Evangelicalism pretty much makes out Christians as free agents. I mean, basically, church is just a glorified Bible study. It is really the concept of the covenantal nature of the church as a visible body with real organization and structure. Man, that's really not really strong in a lot of evangelicalism here in America. And so the principle we're talking about here is Christ has ordained the structure within the visible church. There are people who have real authority, who have been given gifts. There is concept of church membership, which is a biblical concept. Learning always takes place within that. Your sanctification takes place within that context. Your growing in the knowledge of the truth takes place in that context. And so what Pastor Adam is warning against, if I'm understanding you correctly, Pastor, is pretending these authority structures aren't there, number one. Number two, setting yourself up almost as a quasi-intellectual guru sort of teacher guy, apart from the bands of church structure, because what can happen in those situations is that people can get a grandiose sense of self. They're not under authority. And then you're starting to lack the elements which Christ has put in place to keep in check sinful pride and obvious distortion and understanding of the truth and a whole series of other things. Is that kind of the principle? You're not just saying, well, let me just give you some wisdom here. It'd be better not to do that. Well, you're saying, I'm giving you a principled position, which is that we must honor real authority because Christ has instituted and established that in the church. And that is the context in which we learn and are discipled and grow in the understanding of the truth.
Yeah. And I mean, as long as you're in that context of that church, you're still living and acting like it's legitimate. So you should act consistently in that way.
Right. You have not been appointed by the elders to become your own little flock group and right. So forth.
I mean, in some cases, maybe you have been. It depends on who you're talking to. But again, I can think of situations where, you know, a guy's learning his Reformed theology or is inclined toward it and is given positions of teaching authority in that church. Now, from my perspective now or our perspective now, we see that whole thing is just...
Get out.
Yeah, get
go
out.
Somewhere where you can do it legitimately.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm saying is I wouldn't ding all those guys for being subversive necessarily while they're going through the process if they're not doing anything that they've been told not to do. That, I mean, that was, for example, my experience. The rules, the more strict restrictions did come later, and we were to abide by them. And part of the problem was if we said honestly we couldn't, then they said, well, you've got to go, type thing.
The waters get very murky here, right? Because in most churches,
but both sides have to be honest.
Yeah.
No less the person who's having Reformed convictions than the other side.
But this murkiness is obviously coming in because of a lack of honoring the biblical government and structures in the church and
Clearly. Teaching
offices, because, you know, this silly small group business where you just sit around, there's no authority, and we just share our ideas, and right. No one's really accountable to anything at all. No objective truth, no objective church structure. These kind of situations can become rife for, developing and cultivating unbiblical views of ministry and can lead to tremendous imbalance. So what he's saying is operate within the framework that you can for a time while you're evaluating your theology. But at some point, you're going to have to make a decision. And I think that's what I want to use as our break point for this. Come back after the break and take up the whole discussion of saying, well, how do we know that we've locked into a set of doctrinal principles and application that are a dividing line? They mean by coming to the knowledge of these things, we know we can't stay where we're at anymore. How do we know we've got those doctrines? So that's your assignment during the break, is to think about those things while you're making yourself a sandwich or you're checking the mail. Come back to tune us in after the break here on Sinners and Saints.
One of the worst things that the Israelites in Babylon had to suffer through was hearing reports from the homeland for those who were left in the land of how they were being slaughtered by all the enemies of God, and how the temple itself was being infiltrated by all kinds of idolatry and people from foreign nations coming in, not to honor Israel's God, but to bring in the names of false gods and offer their sacrifices to them in the temple, and then to destroy the temple and kill everyone.
Hi, my name is Adam Kalustian. I'm pastor of Ontario United Reformed Church, and I invite you to worship with us on Sundays at 10 a.m. and 5:30 p.m. When you come, let me tell you what to expect. Biblical worship and expository preaching centered on the glorious gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ and his call to live in obedience to his commands. Simple, no gimmicks, old school, historic Protestant religion. If you live in Ontario, Chino, Upland, Rancho Cucamonga, anywhere out there, you got to get in here and visit us. You are more than welcome. We've been here over 85 years. We don't plan on going anywhere, and we would be privileged to serve you. Check us out on the web, OntarioURC.org. Your Spanish-speaking friends, family, neighbors, bring them too. They can worship at 10 o'clock in the Spanish language service with my colleague, Pastor Ruben Cernas. We'll see you Sunday at Ontario United Reformed Church.
Okay, back here after the break on Sinners and Saints, and we're heading to the championship rounds here as we continue to tackle this topic of what do? You're in the wrong church. You are learning the right theology, and you begin to see you're in the wrong church. We're using this article here by Pastor DeYoung to help us think through how do you go about dealing with this. Do you become a grassroots revolutionary with all of the zeal of the most righteous reformer, or do you go another route? And we've thought through some of the ways to handle it so far. Now we come to really what is the dividing line. How do you know it's time to go? How do you know it's time to go? Not trying to be poetic here. I'm not trying to bust a rhyme. I'm just saying, how do you know? How do you know you have the right theology? And this is what Dion gets into. He says, try to discern the relative importance of your concerns. Are your concerns weighty or trivial? Now, these are good qualifications, because you don't just leave the church over minor, very peripheral, minor things. You got to have serious doctrinal backing and warrant for your position. So what we have to think through at this point, Pastor, is let's be very specific. What kind of doctrines are dividers?
Right. So I think that both the Belgic Confession of Faith and the Westminster Confession of Faith are helpful on this particular point, because I do think the Bible speaks to it, but indirectly. Okay, so the question is really, we all know that even within any given local church, there are going to be disagreements. But what kind of doctrinal or practical disagreements rise to the level of making it a church that you should or shouldn't belong to? And the way that the Belgic Confession and the Westminster Confession tackle that issue is by speaking of the marks of a Christian church. Now, they attack the question different ways in my reading. The Belgic Confession says you have to understand that there are two categories: true church and everything else, or false church. It calls it sect, false church, different names for it. But there's only two categories from the perspective of the Belgian Confession: true church or false church. And it gives you three marks that characterize the true church. And if you can see those marks clearly, then you may have confidence that it is a true church, a legitimate place. Christ's presence and authority is there. And then the Westminster Confession comes along and says,
"Well, let me just read it here.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead. But say it. Read it first.
Well, I think it's important to have the precise language, because you're right. They do the same job, in my view. They do it from different angles,
right.
And I think the angle of the Westminster at this point, I think, does enrich and help nail down one element of the Belgic here. And paragraph two says the visible church, which is also Catholic or universal in the gospel, consists of those throughout the world that profess the true religion and their children. Then paragraph three says, unto this Catholic visible church. Which one?
This.
Which Catholic visible church? The one that consists of believers and their children. It says, unto this true visible church, Christ has given the ministry, the oracles, the ordinances of God. So,
and the health, I was going to point out a little bit later, where it talks about the health of a particular church is greater or lesser in view of its faithfulness to the preaching of the gospel, the administration of the sacraments, and the exercise of church discipline. But we don't want to misread that and think that the Westminster is saying something different than the Belgic. The Belgic is saying, here's the difference between true and false churches. Here are the marks: the preaching of the gospel, the pure preaching of the gospel, the legitimate administration of the sacraments, and the exercise of church discipline. And the Westminster Confession comes along and says, within those legitimate churches, you're going to have churches that are more or less faithful,
right,
depending on their maturity and righteousness relative to those three marks. But we have to read these confessions, I believe, together, as opposed to, well, everybody's on the relative scale. Nobody's really illegitimate as long as they name the name of Christ. They just be very, very... No. The answer to the question coming out of the break that we're asking is, how do you know?
Yeah.
Is you look at the church and you see whether or not it bears the three marks of the true church. And if it doesn't, you got to get out of there, because it's not a church.
Well, just listen to, again, to this church is the ministry and the ordinances committed. And then it goes on in paragraph four to say that the Catholic Church has been sometimes more, sometimes less visible. Particular churches which are a member of that visible church are more or less pure. Now, listen to that. A lot of times people take that in the wrong way. They say, oh, aha, what you can have is churches that are more or less pure, which means you could be going to some sectarian outfit that speaks in tongues, has no concept of worship.
Arminian gospel.
And they're Baptists, and the believer's baptism only. And they'll say, what that is an example of less pure. No. That doesn't work. Because, see, we read using grammar. That's how we read. Now, if you don't want to read using grammar, that's up to you. But you can't understand statements unless you use grammar. And the grammar here forces us to say that the only churches that are in the discussion that could be qualified as more or less pure are those churches that consist of believers and their children. You can't have a situation where those two features are not met and have a true church. You can't even, they're not in the discussion of more or less pure. And then unto that church that consists of believers and their children, which are more or less pure, it goes on to say, according as the doctrine of the gospel is taught and embraced, ordinances administered, and public worship performed more or less purely in them. So in other words, what it's saying here is we don't get to decide to shove into this less pure category whatever we want. No, there are objective restraints. There are criteria that have to be met. You are not in the more or less pure discussion if you don't baptize babies as members of the covenant, period. So this is a dividing line, Pastor.
Right. So, all right.
We've got them right here. Objective marks, covenantal dimensions. These are where the discussion is.
Right. Now, some people have asked me, for example, well, why these three marks? I mean, aren't there other important things? And there are other important things, theologically, practically important, things that cause division among local churches because they can't, you know, come to agreement on them. So I agree with that. But I firmly believe in this this idea of some things being more prominent and worth dividing over in this sense, and some things being secondary. And so if you're asking me, well, how do you make the distinction? The thing that I see in common between the three marks, the pure preaching of the gospel, the legitimate administration of the sacraments, and the faithful exercise of church discipline is the presence of Jesus Christ. I mean, the fundamental character of the church is that Christ is there saving and sanctifying his people. And in the preaching of his gospel, that's his voice speaking to his people through the, you know, the foolish ministers, the foolish instruments that have been appointed as his ambassadors. And the Spirit has a special promise that he will work through the preaching of the gospel to save and sanctify his people and to seal them to the day of redemption. So if you don't have the pure preaching of the gospel, you don't have the voice of Christ, and so you don't have a church because Christ is not speaking to his people there, or worse.
That should go without – this is so – I'm listening to you. This sounds bizarre that we would have to say that the true preaching of the gospel is a mark.
Well,
when Paul says so clearly,
well, but you have to
if
think about
we or an angel from heaven preach you any other gospel, let him be anathema.
Yeah,
why is this a
well, it's not so much that people have in view the false teaching. I mean, in other words, somebody would not come to us, I think, and say, well, if all we heard in our church and all we had access to in some church was like completely false preaching of the gospel,
Arminianism?
They would argue. No, but this is what they would say. I'm just trying to imagine here. They're going to say, well, there may be some Arminianism taught or tolerated in the churches, but look what I get. I have my own Bible. I go to the Ligonier conferences. I read my Geneva Study Bible. I listen to the White Horse Inn. Maybe my youth pastor or one of the associate pastors has Reformed leanings and teachings, and in his small group or, you know, in his service, he kind of teaches that. So that legitimizes, like, that means that the pure preaching of the gospel is there. And we're saying, no, wait a minute.
That's impossible.
Well, listen.
It's not a gospel.
First of all, it's not preaching in some of those cases. All that, you know, my private Bible reading and my little flock group where I talk to each other about, is not preaching.
No.
So that's one point.
Yep.
The other point is, it is impossible for the pure preaching of the gospel and the preaching of the false gospel to coexist. So let's think about that. It is impossible for the pure preaching of the gospel and the preaching of a false gospel to coexist. Something is going to give, and if it's not giving, it's because the person who is purportedly preaching the true gospel is not really doing it, because there is no, how should we say, winsome response by those who don't believe it to the preaching of the gospel. It's the aroma of death, Paul says. They hate it,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to snuff it out. And the only way you can get away with it is if it's secretive, behind the scenes, and this going back to what we said earlier, subversive in the context of that authority structure in that church. And if somebody is getting along with these false teachers, what does that say about what they're teaching? So they can't coexist.
Well, let's make this practical right away, right. Pastor Adam. Number one, if you're in a church that preaches an Arminian gospel, get out now.
Yes.
It's a false gospel, which means it's a false church.
And I don't want to hear anything. Look, the Arminians redefine justification.
Yeah.
Even if you don't want to quibble about finer points of predestination or whatever, fine. But the Arminian theologians have redefined justification. So what do you want? I mean, how can you defend that?
So good rule of thumb is if at the end of your service, every week your pastor is asking you to do altar calls and ask Jesus into your heart, leave. That's a false gospel, because the gospel is not about Jesus being asked into your heart. I defy you to find that anywhere in the Bible. It's not a biblical gospel. So this is real simple here. Number one is false gospel means false church means get out.
Okay,
wait on that one.
Now, coming back to what I said.
Number two.
So what is the second mark, legitimate administration of the sacraments, have to do? What does it have in common with the preaching of the gospel? Because I said what the common strand is biblically is the presence of Christ. So Christ is speaking to his people to save and to sanctify them through the preaching of the pure gospel. If the gospel's not there, he's not there, except in judgment. What is happening in the sacraments is that people are being engrafted into Jesus Christ, and that mystical union which has been established by the Holy Spirit through the sacraments is being intensified through the regular celebration of the Lord's Supper.
Mm-hmm.
So there is something unique that is happening in the symbolic ceremonies of baptism and the Lord's Supper. It is that it is not merely symbolic or memorial, but you have an actual intensification of the mystical union of Jesus Christ with his people.
Okay, well, let's
unto their life. So he
practical.
Is there. He is there in a real way. If those sacraments are not being administered according to his command, then he's not there.
Okay, so you're at a church where baptism is believer's baptism. It's your testimony that you have come to Jesus and died with him. That's your theology. No babies come with you. No children of believers come in that one at all, because they can't say that they have died with Jesus. So if you're in a church that holds that, and you're in a church that holds to a form of communion where taking the bread and the wine is just about remembering what happened way long ago in the rearview mirror of history shot where Jesus was dying on a cross, and you take the bread and the wine, you say, that's all I'm doing here is remembering. It's a memorial service.
Yeah.
What do you have? Well, you have two false views of the sacrament. One is a view of the sacrament which has nothing to do with covenant, you being signified and sealed and set apart to be a part of the covenant and people of God, and the promises of the covenant being made unto you, number one, to your children. Number two, which, remember, the Westminster Confession says, the visible church consists of believers and their children. And so this sacrament makes the church visible in the world. When the baptism is administered to the believers and their children, that church is made visible for the world to see. It can find the church now. So then the other one here is the Lord's Supper.
Let me say something about that real quick, Pastor. Look, it's simple. Now, again, this is assuming that you've become convinced biblically of the practice of baptizing covenant children. But assuming you become convinced of that, how can you stay in a church that doesn't baptize Christians? I assume that people who are convinced of paedobaptism would never stay in a church that didn't baptize adult converts, because they just see that so obviously inconsistent with basic biblical teaching. Well, if you become convinced of paedobaptism, how can you stay in a church that refuses to baptize members of the covenant.
Here's how I put it, Pastor Adam. You could no more claim that you were in a true Christian church that if they didn't baptize the children of believers,
they didn't baptize anybody.
Jew who goes to a synagogue that doesn't circumcise, that doesn't mandate the circumcision of the children of male Jewish believers.
Right.
You could no more say that's a true synagogue than you could say this is a true church if they fail and refuse to baptize the subjects of the promise of the covenant, which includes believers and their children. So here you have a very obvious situation. And you know, look, it's great to pray for humility. It's great to have the right demeanor, attitude, and approach. It's great to talk to your pastor and elders and be as accountable as you can be. But at the end of the day, you must not be accountable to a pastor and a group of elders who tell you that you can't present your child for baptism. You cannot be accountable to them because they have no authority to mandate that your child be kept away from the baptismal font. They have zero authority there.
Yeah.
You have to leave.
Yeah.
Period.
And then coming to the Lord's Supper, you mentioned it. I cut you off, but you know, you're in a context partaking the Lord's Supper where it's taught explicitly that it's a serious but merely a memorial service. Paul's very clear. You know, the one who discerns not the body of Christ when they partake is eating and drinking condemnation unto himself. You have to be in a place where the reality of what's happening in the Lord's Supper is taught, so that people, and granted it's a difficult concept, but that's partly because it's not taught to us from the time that we're young, but cultivating the idea that we are actually participating in, as Paul says, in the body and blood of Christ, that we are being reconstituted and that our actual union with him is being intensified, that as organic and real as our connection, body and soul is and was to our first father, Adam, so we are being supernaturally ingrafted and made part of the Son of Man, all the more as we partake in the sacrament of the Lord's Supper. This is something we have to hear, at least in the broad context of an understanding of the Lord's Supper.
I hope you really paid attention to those words that Pastor Adam quoted there from 1 Corinthians chapter 11, where the Apostle Paul talks about eating and drinking judgment to yourself if you discern not the Lord's body. Ask yourself a question. If partaking the bread and the wine had nothing to do with feeding upon the body and blood of Christ, and it was a pure memorial, how in the world could the Apostle Paul justify the use of that language? How in the world could Paul say, you are eating and drinking judgment unto yourself if you discern not the Lord's body, if you weren't feeding on the body of the Lord? That would be an impossibility. That would be a sloppy, misleading, deceptive use of language. Hey, the reason why we believe we feed on the body and blood of Christ in the supper is because of the language. Paul says, is not the bread which we break communion with the body of Christ? Is not the cup which we drink communion with what? The memory of Christ's shed blood? No, no, no. He says, is it communion with the blood of Christ? And then he drives that point home later on in context in 1 Corinthians 10, comparing the participation in the sacrament and a real participation in the sign, what the signs and seals represent, which is the body and blood of Christ. He compares that over against a Jewish person under the old economy, eating the sacrifice of the altar. He says there was a real participation with the things they represented. And he goes on to say, this is the reason why you cannot go to the pagan temple and partake of the sacrifice, the meat sacrifice to idols there, because the meat represents mystical union connection with the thing signified, the pagan thing. And he says, Paul says, I don't mean that there's a pagan god there. He says it is a communion with demons. So by partaking of the flesh of the meat sacrificed to an idol, Paul says there is real communion with the demonic. Now, if that was all mere memorial, just external ceremony, there's no real participation Paul would begin be using a deceptive use of, it would be a deceptive use of language. He would be saying things for which there is no warrant and no basis at all. And if that were the case, the entire admonition of 1 Corinthians 10 falls flat. He would have you being worried about chasing spooks and ghosts where they don't exist. The reason why that language is so powerful is not just because it's emotive or evocative or melodramatic. The reason why that language is so powerful is because he is saying there is a real participation in the things which are represented by the signs. And that is why we have to discern the Lord's body. Again, this comes down to what is the nature of the sacrament? Is it just some mere ceremony with no real significance to it all besides the memory that I bring to it? Or is there a real communion with Christ?
Right. So if you have in the preaching of the pure gospel, the voice of Christ to save and sanctify his people, and you have in the administration of the sacraments, the ingrafting of God's people into Christ and the intensification of their actual union with him, his real presence there to save and sanctify them, then you, if you don't have those things, you don't have... You can't have confidence that Christ is there. Now, let me make a quick point about that. It's not that Christ cannot or does not work outside of these means. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there are places where false gospels are preached. There are places where so-called sacraments are illegitimately distributed, and Christ still works, condescends, and works in spite of that. There are places outside even the forms of those things where Christ works to save his people. That's wonderful, and we give thanks to the Lord for that. But we're asking the question of, if I'm in a church, where should I go? How can I have confidence that where I am is legitimately calling itself a church and Christ is there in the way that he has told us that he is present to our ability to discern? And that would be by recognizing these marks. And real quick, from my point of view, the third mark, the administration of church discipline. It's like Jesus, Matthew 18, where two or three are gathered, one of the most famously misquoted passages ever in the right. Bible. But anyway, the context there, church discipline, where you have two or three are gathered, meaning where you have the official pronouncement ultimately of the church that a person, about a person's spiritual condition, Christ says, I am there with you. Basically, you have the presence of Christ there shielding his people and shepherding them, positively speaking, shepherding them into the kingdom in true doctrine and true Christian life, negatively, keeping out the wolves and the hypocrites. So you want to be in a place where Christ is there to help us along the way. Where is he? Where two or three are gathered? Well, that's in the context of the exercise of church discipline, when he was instructing the apostles how in a rudimentary form that would take place. So it's all a question of what is primary versus secondary. Secondary things are important, but what is primary is, where is Jesus?
Yeah.
And I know where Jesus is. I know where Jesus is when I can hear his voice, when the pure when his pure gospel is preached, where his sacraments are administered, not just where he's portrayed, but what he's doing through them is proclaimed, and he's exercising discipline.
Let's do a little rhetorical judo here. You're saying these marks are ultimately about, where do I find Jesus? Well, what's the opposite of that? If you got the wrong sacrament, the wrong preaching of the gospel, and the wrong church discipline, what do you have?
The wrong Jesus.
You got no Jesus. You got no Jesus or the wrong Jesus. And this is why the language, again, of the Westminster Confession is so important, when it says, unto this visible Catholic, not another, not one that preaches a false gospel, not one that has empty sacraments, not one that doesn't have a visible form of church government. Pastor DeYoung says, hey, let's think about the things that are important, the things that we really should say, this matters so much, I got to separate, I got to leave, here they are. And they sent around Christ and saying, Christ isn't there. Christ isn't there when the word is falsely preached, and when the sacraments are not real sacraments, and when there is no church discipline as Christ is appointed, because those are the ways which Christ has made his church visible in the world, and those are the ways in which Christ says, I will be with you even at the end of the age. So here you are, you're sitting here, you're thinking about this stuff, and you say, all right, I'm there. I believe Belgic Confession, Article 27, I believe Westminster 25, Paragraph 2 and 3. Now what do I do? You look around your community, there's no Reformed church. Yeah, there's a Baptist church down the street that supposedly preaches a little bit of Calvinism. But it's not Reformed. There's really nothing else. There's a Methodist church. There's a community church. But you're looking, there's nothing there. So, Pastor, this is the question that I think is so pressing, and we get this question so often. What do we do? There's no Reformed church. You're telling me these are dividing issues. You're telling me that this is the one we got to go to a true church for. We need to go seek one out. And yet, everywhere I look around me, there's no church. Now, what do I do? Maybe there's a liberal Presbyterian PCUSA down the road. They got a woman pastor. They got basically rank idolatry, gross paganism, basically, in their theology and their word. What do you do?
Well, you need...
What do we do?
Okay. Practically speaking, you got to find a true church as nearby as you can, or that you have some connection to, that is willing to work with you practically on this problem. I mean, I think you got to join a local church, and if there isn't, by local, if there is one, not one geographically local to you, you have to join a local church that's out of town, or at least get in a substantive contact with a local church, its pastor and its elders, to shepherd you through the decision-making process of your situation. You know, whether that means they advise you over the shorter or the longer term to move, or whether they advise you over the shorter or the longer term to participate in a church planting effort in your area, or any number of options, or even join for a temporary period of time long distance while they continue to think about it. You know, something, but that you get connected to a true church has to happen, even if there's one, not one in your local town.
We've been through this sometimes before with some listeners, and we've tried to set that up, and we know it can be difficult, but it can be done. There are situations where we've helped people make contact with a church that is located somewhere, hence a local church, and set up their membership with that church while they work through the issues in their own community. Maybe moving is going to end up being what they have to do. Maybe staying where they're at, but receiving a long-distance ministry until they can put together a core group, till a church plant can start. A number of things could happen. So this is what we would say, a practical application of this whole discussion. And I think it's a valuable one. I appreciate Pastor DeYoung making a post about this issue because it is important. What should I do? I don't become a revolutionary. I don't destroy the church from the bottom up where I'm at. I recognize that it's not a true church. Now I go. I seek a fellowship with a true church. And then from there, we'll see what the Lord does. Does he lead you to move from town, or does he lead you to wait there until we can get a church plant going that builds a biblical Reformed church from the bottom up? But make no mistake about it. Your theology does matter. I hope that really gets impressed here. Your theology does matter, and your theology must be put into practice. It cannot just be in my head and say, well, these people say this and that, and I know I don't agree with them on the gospel and the sacraments and all that, but I have my theology and it's in my head and I'm okay because I got my ideas straight. No, God doesn't call you to be a part of that. God calls you to be part of the visible church. So you need to make sure that you follow through and apply your theology to life. And this is one way: biblical church membership. So we've been talking about some big issues here today. If you want to jump on the Facebook, go ahead and do it. Put your thoughts down, send out some questions, generate some discussions. And as always, we thoroughly enjoy having these conversations with you. But we hope that thinking through some of these issues about what do I do with my theology once I have it straightened out and from the Bible and see that it's reformed, well, you have to act on it in appropriate and godly and Christ-honoring way. Well, we thank you for joining us today on Sinners and Saints.